You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What do Wyatt Earp, Bell Gunness, Bigfoot the Renegade, Billy the Kid, and Dr. H.H. Holmes and the Black Hand have in common? They were all subjects of true crime newspaper reporting in the 1800s, and now these stories and that of many others are brought together in their original form in a two-volume set. True Crime Chronicles, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s. Compiled and commented on by New York Times bestselling author Mike Rothmiller, these classic works of journalism resurrect astonishing stories that will take the reader back to when these horrific tales mesmerized a nation. Some may find these articles and their descriptions of people and crimes shocking by today's standards, but they are representative of the most colorful true crime stories of the day. True Crime Chronicles Volume 1 includes stories about Bell Gunness, who had a penchant for killing men and feeding them to her hogs, Dr. Holmes and his murder castle, the Bloody Benders, Anna Amelia Dyer, the Baby Farmer, the darker side of Wyatt Earp, and the forerunners of the American Mafia, the Black Hand. Imagine yourself accompanying these reporters visiting the crime scenes, interviewing witnesses, and penning the stories of murder, lynchings, evil, and swift frontier justice. True Crime Chronicles. The book that we're featuring this evening is True Crime Chronicles, Volume 1, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s, with my special guest, journalist and author and historian, Mike Rothmiller. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Mike Rothmiller.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. You're quite welcome.
Thank you so much. Just give us a little bit of your background as a detective, and tell us what was the impetus and for this True Crime Chronicles. And maybe tell us a little bit about your background as an author as well.
Okay. I was a police officer in Los Angeles for 10 years. I worked patrol as a training officer. I was a field supervisor, watch commander, and I worked undercover vice in Hollywood for 18 months, which was very real eye-opener.
Yeah.
And then I worked undercover, on organized crime and intelligence for 5 years, and that was working on the traditional old Italian mafia, the Russian mafia, Israeli mafia, and any other organized crime group that came along. I left the PD, became a TV reporter, ended up being exec producer and hosting my own show on ESPN. And then along the line, I wrote, it's over 25 books now, and almost all of them, except for just a handful, are all true. And that's been my background. It's just fascinating looking into true crime and other issues that the government doesn't want you to know about, secrets. So this right. particular book, these two volumes, I came across it. I was researching an incident for another book, and I got into the archives of across the country and into the National Archives and the archives in Britain and so forth, and I started coming across stories that were written about serial killers, murderers, and bizarre crimes that occurred in some to the 1700s and then into the 1800s. And I was fascinated by the stories because they were written by journalists. They appeared in newspapers, but the way they wrote the stories, they got into great detail. They were, without question, the most knowledgeable people at the time investigating these, let's say, murders, because they would go out right. a lot of times with the detectives. and they would find evidence a lot of times. And so they wrote very graphically about it, very well detailed. And so it is without question they were the best accounts of those crimes from the time, because court records are non-existent anymore from the 1700s and 1800s in most cases. So these were the best sources of evidence and stories of those crimes at the time. So anyway, I went through it, and I kept finding more and more interesting stories. And then I contacted the publisher, Wild Blue Press, and said, hey, I've got these wonderful stories. What do you think? And they said immediately, let's do it. These things are just too interesting not to put out in print. So that was the genesis of the books, and they're doing extremely well.
Oh, absolutely. So deservedly so. Let's talk about the summary that you have right at the beginning of what is covered in these True Crime Chronicles. And this came out in October 2020, this book. Can you just go through what's contained in there, as you do with the serial killers and who's mentioned and the baby farmers? Can you go through that for us?
Oh, sure, yeah. The serial killers, that starts the book. There are three true serial killers, Bell Guinness, Dr. Holmes, and the Bender family. Then I get into what was called the baby farmers, which are primarily in England, but people just didn't understand what they were. Even people in England didn't realize they had a history of this. And they were, for a better term, women would advertise in the 1700s, 1800s, say, if you can't take care of your child or you want to give it up secretly, you give me, at the time, like say, equivalent to $20, which would be several hundred, several thousand,
right,
and I'll take care of your child. I'll raise it, or I will put it out for adoption, and don't worry about it. So these women would do it. As soon as these people were paid, the woman left the child there. They would kill the baby and throw the baby in the Thames River. And I've got stories of three women who were doing it, and at best guess, they probably killed close to 1,000 babies in that fashion.
Wow.
So that's one. There were. I also have a chapter about lynchings that went on in the U.S., and that really struck me interesting, because most people believe, and rightfully so, that the vast majority of lynchings were conducted by white mobs on African Americans. They'd break them out of jail, they would capture
right.
them, they would hang them, so forth. Well, that was true, but also I have in there articles regarding African American groups who got together and went out and lynched African Americans for the same crimes. And
right.
so that's something that has really been forgotten in history, that this occurred. So I have stories about that. I have stories about some women and a man who were basically accused of being a witches in England, and how they were killed. Then I get into the Old West regarding the Earp family, Doc Holliday, other ones like that. And primarily talking about the dark side of the Earp family, the Dalton gang, and then what I found was really intriguing was Bigfoot the Renegade was a guy that led some Paiutes on raiding parties, and he was amazing. He was a giant for the time physically. They said he weighed over 300 pounds, solid muscle, was like 6 foot, they guessed like 6 foot eight, maybe a little bit larger, but just phenomenal story about him. And then the Black Hand, they were the forerunners of, if you want to say, the Mafia, when they really
right.
kind of changed names and got into other crimes in America. So I have that. I have the assassination of President Garfield in there from
right.
what happened, how it went down, and the person who was caught and eventually executed. Then I have a good number of short stories that I found were truly fascinating. There are probably about 20 of them in there, of just various bizarre crimes and the way people were treated back then. There's a dentist refused to be horsewhipped because he wrote a letter to a girl in another town that she thought was kind of embarrassing, off color. So
right.
that was a crime. And so they decided to horsewhip this dentist, and he wouldn't go for it. He says no, and he barricaded himself in his office, and then they finally parlayed And the girl said, okay, if he comes out and apologizes to me publicly, we won't horsewhip him, but he's got to leave town. And so that was the deal that was cut. He came out and said, I'm sorry for the letter, and he left town. The very strange things, and then some very strange murders that occurred back during the 1800s. There's one in particular that sticks out in my mind, is that a girl caused a boy to be murdered. She was walking by a small encampment of basically Mexican woodcutters. She got home, tells her dad that one of the, some boy there made some comment to her that was unseemly. They go back there, and they force the people there to whip this boy, and they whip him to death. Yeah. And then the girl says, well, you know, he really didn't say that to me. I lied about it. And just went on. Yeah. Nothing happened. There was a wholesale slaughter of 34 Chinese miners along the river that have their story in there, and the people who were caught and why they did it. Interesting one about two teenage female outlaws that were very young, and they take off, and they were selling alcohol to the Indians, which was illegal, and when the posse started going after them, they had a shootout with the posse, and the only reason they surrendered because they ran out of ammo, and it was kind of looked at as a crime, shooting it out with the deputies, but it really wasn't handled that way. They just basically took them in, sent them to a reform school, you know.
Yeah, so they're young.
They're just very, very strange stories in there. And one's about other people. There was a lot of axing going on, people being axed to death. And so various stories about that. And then an interesting editorial I closed the book with where the newspaper said, don't make heroes out of criminals.
Yes.
And that was based on a fellow that shot his girlfriend through the head and left her out next to a road. And they were kind of playing it up like they do today in some respects. You know, they get a lot of coverage, and they're kind of turning him into a hero and so forth. So there's just a lot of stories like that.
What you mentioned, too, as well, but lots of these stories with the media, there wasn't a legal barrier at that time. So it did allow them to have access to detectives. And like you say, they often went along with detectives in some of these stories and were instrumental in discovering evidence as well. So this is unique aspect of these stories. Tell us some of the other things that were evident when you went through this information that really bring these stories to life no other way.
Well, one is that they're very detailed. When I'm talking about that, they'll say that the person took an axe and split their skull open and the brains were scattered throughout the room and so forth. Very graphic and very detailed, where today, when I was a cop investigating things like that, you would never release those details. One, you'd never let a reporter in to a crime scene to look around. And two, there are certain things that you would always keep confidential because only the killer would know. So then you can eliminate people who are giving false confessions. But in these cases, in these stories, the reporters in most cases were there. They accompanied the detectives or the sheriff or whoever it was to the scene. They, many cases, they found the evidence, some of the evidence, and they examined it. And then they went to a lot of the people who were arrested, and they would get an interview from them fairly fast. They said, why did you kill so-and-so? Well, you know, he owed me $5, and he wouldn't pay it back, so I took an axe and cut his head off. And they would just lay it out, where today, for the last 40, 50 years, it says, you got to Mirandize people. You can't do this. You can't do that. If they say they want an attorney, that ends everything. Even if they say they want their mother, a lot of times the investigation or the interrogation. And so it brings back what an investigation was how it was conducted in the 1800s. What went on before Mirandizing, before, you know, attorneys really got involved. how the cops would operate, and in many cases, how the suspects or the arrestee, they would just absolutely come out and just confess proudly. And then when they were being taken to the gallows to be executed, you know, a lot of them just walked up there and said, hey, this is part of the game. Now I'm going to be hung. And they were very cool and collected. And they confessed once more before they were hung. So it's just, it brings that history to life by reading this. The words, the quotes that are in there, the interrogations and so forth. It's just a fascinating look at crime from over a century ago. How they were investigated, how people were treated, as far as criminals in most cases, there was very few appeals if they were convicted in a, say, a county court and they were sentenced to death. In most cases, there was no appeal. That was it. And in many cases, they had to hang them within 30 days or within 3 months. And that's what they did. They just waited and said, okay, that's it. We're going to hang you now. And so it's just, it's a real eye-opener to see how things have changed.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Let's talk about the serial killers that you do cover here, because, of course, they're some of the most famous, and the coverage of it is absolutely fascinating as well that you include in this book. Let's start with a little bit of what you did learn about probably a killer that you knew somewhat about, Bell Gunness, in through these articles that you present in this book.
Yeah, Bell was a very interesting woman, needless to say. Very cold, very deliberate in the way she murdered people. She was, for a better term, she had like a B&B, and she would invite men over. And sometimes she would marry them, sometimes she wouldn't. And when they would go to bed, she would chloroform them. And if that didn't kill them outright, she would just sometimes use a knife or use an axe and behead them. And then she would take them out to her garden and bury them. And in many cases, from all the stories I read about it, is that she would generally plant something over where she buried the person, a small tree, some other plant. And that way she would know not to bury the next one there, because she would dig up the one that she buried the day before or the month before. So she was interesting. And then it appears once some people got on to her, what she was doing, she had, for a better term, a helper that would help her now and then, Ray Lampier. And her house was burned down. And in the basement, once, you know, everything was settled, they found three children. She had three children. They found the bodies of three children. They found the body of a woman that was beheaded. And they didn't find the head. And so they were guessing, said, well, this is might be Bell, because the body size is about the same, but it may not, because she was so ruthless, she would have killed her three kids and also found somebody else, killed that woman, took her head so she couldn't be identified, and just took off. And so the mystery remains, is that Bell, was that her body or not, in the basement of that burned out house? And so when you get into the details, how she operated and how she was discovered, it's truly fascinating. The detailed work that some other people did back then, looking for relatives that they knew went past her house, and then they started coming back saying, wait a minute, we think she may be the person involved. And when it started closing in on her, that's when the house went down, and some believed at the time that it was her farmhand who helped bury the bodies, basically killed her and burned the house down with the kids, because there was a deal that went down and he didn't believe he was paid enough for it from this one killing. So it's just a fascinating look at a female serial killer from that time frame. And frankly, there aren't that many serial killers. As you know, most of them are males. So it takes you into the psychic of this woman and the way she brutally murdered people and just went about her business like she's slaughtering a hog. You know, sometimes she would go out and feed them to her hogs in the little wallow area. And when the police finally were there looking around, one of the hogs came up and had a human bone in its mouth it was gnawing on. So,
yeah,
she was pretty cruel.
Yes. You talk about next the Bender family, which you call the most intriguing serial killer family during the late 1800s. Oh, well, most intriguing serial killer family, period, but operating during the late 1800s, a family of four. And again, sort of not a bed and breakfast, but inviting travelers to have a meal and spend the night, very similar to, I guess, a bed and breakfast. Tell us what this ends up being, the legend of where these people went. Tell us a little bit about what these articles inform people about the Bender family through these articles.
Well, the articles talk about the beginning, how they were, what they were doing and how they were killing people and how it was discovered, and then how the Benders vanished. And basically what they would do, they had, like you said, they had a small, for a better term, a small room that was a store in their house, and they had a house out in the middle of nowhere along this traveled dirt road. And when people were going by, primarily they would invite men in to spend the night, single men, if they thought they had any money with them, any valuables. And the daughter, she would engage the person in a conversation. They had a table where they sat down to eat. They'd always put the person's back to the window that was open directly behind them. And as the daughter, who was like early 20s, would engage the person in conversation, either the father or husband would come up behind them, hit them in the back of the head with a hammer or an axe. There was a trap door just below them. They would pull the trap door. The person would fall into the basement. And if they were still alive, the mother was down there with a large knife or an axe, and she would behead the person. And then they would go ahead and take the valuables and so forth. And once again, they would take the body out and bury him at night somewhere on their property, generally in their near the gardens and so forth. And this went on for some time, and it was like an early version B&B, so it was very bloody. And when they were basically being detected what they were doing, they took off one night, all of them. And over the next few years, there would be a story about a Bender or somebody they thought was a Bender, one of the men or one of the women, were apprehended in, you know, North Carolina. Then they'd find out, no, that wasn't one of the Benders. And then there'd be another one apprehended someplace else. No, that wasn't them. So the whole family just vanished. And to this day, nobody knows where they went, if they split up or they stayed together. But they were never caught. And so it was, again, a very interesting story that you would see on 48 Hours or something like that, but they escaped. And it's one of the great mysteries, what happened to the Benders. So it's a very detailed story, and it goes through a number of the people they killed and how the bodies were found and the condition of the bodies when they were discovered on the property, and a good number of bodies. And they probably did not find all the bodies if they buried them away from the house, because they just primarily looked around the house in that area when they were searching for bodies. So it's an interesting situation where it was a family that were serial killers. They killed together. And generally it's just a single individual or two. And in this case, it was a family, a husband and a wife, their daughter and son-in-law. So it's kind of shocking when you read the story about the entire family.
Absolutely. What I commented, want to comment, is that unlike reporters today, these articles are written very much like in-depth, like an author that would have access to court transcripts and evidence and the kind of information that police departments would have. That being said, one of the most fascinating stories in this incredible collection happens to be H.H. Holmes. And headlines like, "Turns out to be a veritable factory for murder, a sealed chamber, a steel vault, a crematory, and quicklime graves. A dark shaft found to run from the sealed room into the house built at Chicago by H.H. Holmes, who is charged with at least 11 murders and suspected of many more." I wanted to say, or at least have this story demonstrate the power of the articles to not only just inform people of the details, but also what I thought was interesting is that there's so much difference between the folklore and the mythology of H.H. Holmes and how many victims, specifically in wild claims about ovaries and young maidens in this place. But I think with these articles, what I found was a very, very much like a journalist today, a very grounded, non-salacious, detailed account of H.H. Holmes, his elaborate murder castle, but also lending credence to that he killed many more people than there was evidence for the police to prove of his murderous bent. And so can we talk about H.H. Holmes and some of these fascinating articles?
Sure, yeah. H.H. Holmes was operating in Chicago starting about 1895. His true name was Herman Webster Mudgett, and he went by H.H. Holmes and a couple other names, and he was a serial killer. He had some medical training. It looks like he probably graduated from medical school, and he was a pharmacist, and he was a swindler. He was a con man. And what he did in Chicago was he built his castle, and the dimensions were it was 162 feet long and 50 feet wide and 3 stories high. And in it, if you've ever seen the Winchester Mystery House, you have doors opening the wall, stairways to nowhere. Mm-hmm. That's how this house was built. And he oversaw it. He swindled most of the work and bricks and so forth from people. So he didn't pay a lot for it, but it was built, and there were rooms that led nowhere. There were sealed rooms. There were mazes. It would be, just think of a corn maze going through it, but it's all enclosed with various doors. And he knew how these secret passages worked through the house, but the detectives didn't when they first went in there. And also the workers, what he would do, he would hire some for a while, and then he would fire them. He turned them over constantly because apparently he didn't want anybody to know how this house really functions, the secret passages, the trap doors, the wiring, the vats to dissolve bodies, and so forth. So he's a very strange, very cunning, and he knew a lot about law enforcement techniques at the time, investigations, and he certainly knew how to dissolve bodies, because in his basement he had 2 vats they found. One had quicklime in it, and the other, they're surmising, it had some sort of oily acid in it. And he would put the bodies in there and dissolve them, and through time, they would even dissolve the bones. Then he was so bizarre, he had one guy articulate 3 of the skeletons that he basically probably put them into the vat of quicklime, and once all the skin and muscle and tissue was gone, it was just a skeleton, he removed them, and he had the guy articulate them so they were standing in different poses. And why he did that, you know, they were obviously trophies to him, but some of the other bodies were completely dissolved. He also had his own crematorium in his basement, and they found some human remains in there, some bones and so forth. but they have no idea how many people he cremated in his basement, how many people he dissolved in his vats of acid and quicklime. But they did find some bones buried in his basement, human bones. And he was so cunning, he also took animal bones and mixed them with the human bones. And so he told them those were soup bones if the police ever found them. Some of them they did find that they were soup bones, but then they identified human bones in there. He also traveled around the country, mainly on the East Coast, and there was always somebody dying near him. Generally had something to do with him, kids or maybe somebody hired as a servant or to work around his castle. So he was very, very strange, but the way the house was set up is that he had a pharmacy on the first level that went out onto the street, and he had the entire second and third floor wired, so when somebody walked down the hall, it would set off, for better term, an alarm in his office, so he knew where people were at all times in the house. They found rooms that had no ventilation whatsoever. Once the person was in there, they would suffocate, or there was a pipe that he would pump in natural gas, and the people would die that way. So he was very cunning. He had a number of ways that he would kill people, and the estimates go from 11 up to several hundred that he killed, and the reason it's so high is that he was set up for the World's Fair in Chicago, and the idea was to get people to come in there and they could spend the night in a room very inexpensively. And there were several hundred people who attended the World's Fair in Chicago that never returned home. They never found a trace of them. So that's where the high number comes.
Right.
And, you know, it's anybody's guess. It really is. It was anybody's guess then. It's anybody's guess today, the exact number that he killed. But he was extremely cunning. And, you know, I guess he would be one of the top serial killers as far as being cool and collected during his time, what he would do, because these people would be obviously be seen going into his castle by some mm-hmm. on the street, and but they never see them again. And so it's very well detailed. The way it's written is the stories, the reporters went through the house and interviewed the detectives that was who were involved in it, and they get into great detail about the secret rooms and the staircases and the vaults that he had, and how people were overcome when they went into the basement when they found this one vat that they said was oily, how they were overcome with it. And then they talk about how he set up a fake gas company, natural gas and so forth, and that he ran a natural gas line underneath, for better term, a big vat of water. He would throw in some chemicals and then start it up, and he'd go, look, boom. He would set the gas afire that was coming up out of the water. And he convinced these people, he was a swindler, that he had these chemicals, whatever they were, and he could turn water into gas and burn it. And so that's, I mean, he was a con man and a mass murderer at the same time. And obviously he was extremely intelligent, but he was very, very deadly.
And what's most fascinating is the reporting showing how very much that he was set up to dispose of bodies en masse. They said that they found it hard to believe he could kill anywhere else, because he really had this veritable factory set up where he could incinerate, dispose of in various ways, people at will. Very, very fascinating.
Exactly. And you know, you think about it in, well, the next century, what the Nazis were doing in concentration camps, the crematoriums, and so forth, disposing of mass amounts of people. And that's what he was doing on a smaller scale. But for an individual, he was very, very active.
Absolutely. We're going to use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is Ritual. Do you really know what's in your multivitamin? Sugars, GMOs, synthetic fillers, artificial colorants, not to mention animal byproducts like sheep's wool and gelatin from hooves and hides, are all ingredients you might find in a multivitamin. But Ritual isn't your typical multivitamin. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly formulas made with key nutrients in forms your body can actually use, no shady extras. My wife Lisa decided to try Ritual about 8 months ago. Based on her reading about Ritual's specific vitamins and nutrients and their sources as compared to other multivitamins, she decided to add Ritual Essential for women into her daily healthy routine of eating healthy and exercise. And she believes right from that day one that it made a difference in her health every day. Now that Ritual has Ritual Essential 50+ is now available for men, I've signed up. And I'll keep you posted. Now available for women and teens, Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. 9 nutrients to help fill the gaps in your diet. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime, and if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. You deserve to know what's in your multivitamin. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, we last spoke of H.H. Holmes and the incredible articles that really demonstrated the access that these reporters had at that time, fascinating articles about one of the most fascinating killers and subjects of all time, H.H. Holmes. You also talked about the baby farms and the reason why people would utilize these baby farms. And tell us a little bit more about this baby farming in terms of the numbers that were, you know, if records can be believed. What kind of numbers are we talking about? Tell us more about baby farming.
The baby farmers were primarily operating in England at the time, England, Scotland, some in Ireland. There were a few in the United States, but very few. But the ones that operated in England have stories of 3 women. And sometimes a young girl or a woman couldn't afford to raise a child, or it was out of wedlock, and back then in the 1800s, you know, that was mm-hmm. a huge thing. And so these baby farmers, they would advertise in the papers in London and other areas that for whatever the fee would be, a nominal fee, they will take your child, no questions asked, and they will raise the child as their own, or they will see that it is adopted into a good family. So there was no shortage of women at the time willing to give up their child, and so they would meet with them generally at their homes, and they would hand over the child. Most cases they were infants with some whatever clothing they had, which was limited, and pay the fee, and then they were assured that the child would be adopted or raised. And just when they would leave, sometimes within a matter of an hour, if not sooner, these women would strangle the baby, put it into a sack, put a rock in the sack, and then throw it into the river. And the way they were discovered is that sometimes they didn't tie the sack and the body would float out. And so down river from this area, they start finding baby bodies floating up and along the shore and so forth. And the police started backtracking, and that's how they came across these people in most cases, as they backtracked and they started going from house to house. And it wasn't like a major city, you know, they're kind of a rural area. And so they finally determined who the people were, the women, and they have the interrogations in there in many cases, in some of the interrogation from the trial. And most of the women ended up, they were hung for their crimes. And body count, they would guess, was well into the hundreds, if not thousands, because these are only three of the women that they were able to arrest and try. Mm-hmm. Other ones were never detected. From other articles I read, they were just, you know, bodies turned up, but they couldn't determine where the child came from. It just washed up on a bank or somewhere. So these women were very diabolical, and for a woman, it was kind of interesting because they were very cruel. They would just take this baby in, and without that instinct that most women would have about a child, they'd just strangle them. They looked at them as a little farm animal. They were just slaughtering, and they just would slaughter them and toss them away. And in one person, this one baby farmer having there, when the police finally arrested her, went to her house, she had over 300 pounds of baby clothing. And now you have to think about that, how many babies that would represent, because in most cases they didn't have a lot of outfits. They had maybe one or two that they would give to the woman when they turned the baby over. So 300 pounds of clothing and baby clothing adds up to a large number. So it's just shocking when you read the stories that these women were serial killers at the time. And there were more than one. There were quite a few in England that were doing it. And so you look at it, it was an industry that was run on murdering babies. You know, so it's a shocking and fascinating story, and it's certainly an eye-opener to the cruelty of a lot of people.
Absolutely. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, one of the most fascinating things in this book, too, as well, is that you talk about the Old West, and you talk about the Earp family, Wyatt Earp and his family, and Doc Holliday. So books, like you say, books, papers, movies have portrayed him as an honorable lawman, bringing desperados to justice. But you say that there's a very, very interesting backstory found in newspaper articles of the day.
Yes.
And as well as law enforcement at that time and at other times considered them that they were a gang of thieves and bandits. So tell us a little bit more about these fascinating articles and the backstory about the Earp family and Doc Holliday.
Sure. When I was researching the book, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to do something about the Wild West then, because the 1800s, late 1800s, that's when it was really going on in the Indian Wars and so forth. And I thought, okay, Wyatt Earp, I've seen the movies, I read the books, you know, I thought I knew the general story. Well, as it turned out, the Earps weren't that clean. And, you know, dating way back when Wyatt was younger, I have an arrest warrant that was issued for Wyatt because he was a horse thief. And what he did, instead of being prosecuted, he took off and ran into Indian territory, and they never caught him. But they would go from town to town, as the story goes, that most people know, is that they would go from town to town. They were lawmen and, you know, fighting the bad guys all the time, and then there was the shootout in Tombstone and so forth. Well, a lot of that's true. Sometimes when they went to a new town, it's because they got chased out of the last town because of criminal activity, and so they'd take off, and in many cases, the jobs that they could find that were open immediately was being a marshal or a sheriff or a deputy, so forth. And so to earn some money while they got a lay of the town, they would take a job as a sheriff, marshal, whatever. And what their main gig was is that they were into robbing stagecoaches, where the other ones, the people were cattle thieves, horse thieves, and so forth. And so they knew who the other criminals were, and when they were in Tombstone, one was acting as a marshal and so forth, but they were also going out during the day if they would learned that a stage was coming in, primarily a Wells Fargo stage, that had cash or gold on it. They would go out and rob it. Then they would come back to town, and the stage would come in, and they basically say, hey, we were robbed. And the Earps would say, well, let's put together a posse and go out and find those desperados. So
yeah.
They put together a posse. They would go out and look for themselves. They never found themselves, and they'd come back. And the way that that scheme was broken is that the agent they had at Wells Fargo, who would tell them when a load was coming in, a load of gold or something, finally broke down and started talking. And that's when the town started going after the Earps, and the Earps left Tucson along with, not Tucson, Tombstone with Doc Holliday. And another story that I found, which just surprised me, is that early on, prior to this, the younger sister of the Earps married. She basically eloped, and they did not approve of this, so they took out after her, and they found her in the next town with her husband, and Ike Clanton, which you remember that name from the OK Corral, and they just started shooting into the hotel where they were at. Well, they missed Ike, and they hit the sister. She was wounded. So Ike grabs her, runs out the back, gets on a horse, holding her, carrying her, takes off. They're in pursuit of them, and he gets up to a mine, which is supposed to be a load of Irish miners there. And he runs in the mine carrying his wounded wife and tells them, these guys are chasing me. They want to kill me. They shot my wife. So the Earps arrive with Holliday. The miners come out. You know, anywhere between 20 and 30 miners come out, and they're armed. And the Earps say, we want him. And they say, no, you're not taking him. You're not getting her. So they chat for a while, and they decide to have a duel. Ike Clanton against one of the younger Earp brothers, and whoever wins, for a better term, gets the girl. So the one Earp brother fires at Clanton, misses. Clanton fires at him, kills him, and the miners say, hey, fair fight. That's the end of it. And so the Earps get out, ready to leave, and unfortunately, Clanton's wife, she died from that gunshot wound. So that goes on, and so there's always some, obviously, animosity between the two, and then they end up down in Tombstone, where Ike is running basically some cattle thieves, the Clantons, and then the Earps are doing their stagecoach robberies, and then they end up shooting it out at the OK Corral, and at that stage, everybody kind of takes off. So the whole thing about the Earps, the story that most people know, is just, it's not accurate. And then Wyatt eventually ends up in San Francisco, and he's basically the referee in this heavyweight boxing match.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt he threw the fight for $2,500 for this guy that basically knocked out the other guy. And the crowd went crazy. They were throwing things up on the stage. Everybody believed, and probably still to this day, that Wyatt was paid off and that he threw the match to this one guy. And so Wyatt's long history was tarnished all the way along from day one when he was young until his death. But it was never – it's never really been reported in – current media or relatively new media or in movies or in books about him. All of that has been left out. And so when I read this, I found it so interesting, and it rewrote history. I said, these stories of the Earps have to be put into the book. Then there's some questions. So, well, are the stories accurate or not? Well, yeah, you have to look at the accuracy, because that's where all historians would be getting their information from, these old articles. And then Wyatt actually sued a newspaper And I've got a quote. It's very funny because he talks about it was a fake story. It was fake news.
Wow.
And so he sued that newspaper. And so if a lot of these stories were not true, he probably would have sued them at the time. But instead, he would always take off, him and his brothers, and go to the next town or the next state. So fascinating story about the Earp family that people are completely unaware of.
Another story you say that's you discovered it, and I've never read it anywhere else, and you say it's an original story too, is this Bigfoot the Renegade. We touched on it a little bit, the 6'8½", 300 pounds, consummate warrior and killer, with a headline, "The Gigantic and Bloodthirsty Renegade Who Led the Peyote Band of the Snake Indians in Their Raids Upon Immigrant Trains Along Snake River in Early Days."
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about what you found.
I never knew about him until I came across these articles, and they called him Bigfoot, and the reason being because his foot measured over 17 inches, and when they would find like wagon trains on the immigrant trail and so forth, where the people were slaughtered, they always found these huge footprints in the dirt, and so they started calling him Bigfoot. And what his father was black. His mother was probably, they're thinking, an Indian or a white woman. And he was just a giant, as you described him, 6'8", 350 pounds. And he was just a giant of a man. And the story is so fascinating because he led a band of Paiute Indians along that area, and they were conducting raids all the time, and they would slaughter people. So in some ways, he was a serial killer too, but he would slaughter the people. He would take their riches, him and his band of Paiutes, and then they would take off, then they'd come back. And what was so fascinating about it is that he didn't ride a horse. They said there was no horse that was large enough for him. And so he would run where his other, the Paiute band, they were on horses in many cases, but he would run and he would keep up with them, or he would outpace them. And in the story, when these guys who actually, they killed him, they ran him down and caught him, he would just stay well ahead of them. They were on horseback, they're on his track, but he would just run and run and run and outrun them. And when they finally found him, cornered him, they shot him a number of times with rifles and didn't kill him. And so they start talking to him, and they get his story. And so the guy is relating the story that Bigfoot was telling them about. But it was Bigfoot the Renegade operating up in that area around the Snake River, a huge giant man, and relatively intelligent. When you read his statements, what he was talking about, he was fairly intelligent, but he was a brutal killer, and in many cases, he would just kill with his bare hands. He didn't need a gun. He didn't need anything else. He would just kill the people with his hands. So it's a fascinating story, and when I first came across it, I read the headline, Bigfoot, and I said, what's this? I was thinking of something on Washington State. Instead, it was this renegade, and it actually was a more interesting story. Bigfoot the Renegade, his entire story's in there, and it is quite fascinating because it's somebody who was a, in some respects, a major part of history, but nobody's ever heard about.
I wanted to talk, too, before I let you go, about the Abbeville Press and Banner, 1885, A Needed Law.
Yeah.
And you have a commentary, too, perhaps the most insane editorial you located during your research. Tell us about this article, and this is contrary to, I mean, you don't see any other indication in this book from these reporters of, again, like you say, sort of an insane reporting. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, I was shocked when I came across, because it was an editorial by this newspaper, and basically what they're talking about, how there should be a hunting season, for a better term, on the blacks, African Americans back then, that should be in line with deer season and turkey season, things like that. There's a season where you can hunt them, and that during this hunting season, it would be okay and understandable to kill a black. And the reason being was that they were upset because some of the people that were, for a better term, farming and had these African Americans as hands and slaves there and so forth, that they would kill them year-round if they were upset about something. And they said that, no, this is wrong because it impacts the harvest season, that you should not be able to kill blacks, even though it's understandable and it's justified, they said, you should not be able to kill blacks during certain months when the harvest is coming in because that would impact the economy of that region. And at first when I read it, I thought, well, wait a minute, is this some kind of weird, bizarre, sarcastic humor? And then I went back and I said, no, this is from the editorial board of the newspaper. And they're dead serious. And then I pulled other editorials from the same newspaper, and I realized that, no, they weren't joking. They are dead serious that there should be a hunting season like there is on other game animals for blacks during that time frame. It's just, it's beyond shocking when you read it.
Yeah, absolutely. What, as well, you talk about the editorial about not making criminals famous or heroizing these criminals. Tell us about that editorial.
Yes, there was a guy broke up with his girlfriend. They were walking. She was walking home with the mother and another person, and he jumps out of the bushes, drags her into the off the road, kills her, and shoots her through the head. And so as he's going to trial, the various newspapers in that area were running articles about it. Well, gee, he was really a nice guy, and some of them that he was, you know, handsome, and you have to understand his position and all this stuff. And this editorial board had enough of that, and they said, which was interesting, they said, hey, this guy is a criminal. He murdered this girl, and we have to quit making heroes out of criminals. They're criminals, so the community stopped talking about him like he's a great guy and fascinated by him. And they wrote this editorial back in the 1800s, and it was rather interesting reading it because it also applies to today. You see how people, any serial killer like Charlie Manson, the rest of them, and the Night Stalker, when they're in prison, they receive love letters and offers to marry them and so forth. And it's the same sort of thing. So don't make these people heroes and don't give them the notoriety. And so that's how I ended volume one of these True Crime Chronicles.
Absolutely. Tell us about volume two and when that was released. And tell us also how people might take a look at your other work. You talked about 25 other books, most of those nonfiction. Tell us about if there's a Facebook page or website where they might take a look at your other work, and tell us a little bit about Volume 2.
Okay, Volume 2 was released this month, and it's already hit number one in its category, but in it I have the stories, many more serial killers, Jack the Ripper, Lizzie Holiday, the Servant Girl Annihilator, which is a very bizarre serial killer, another gal who was in Europe, her penchant was for poisoning people. Then you had the Atlanta Ripper, which was kind of like Jack the Ripper out of England. Then you had the New York Ripper, which was the same. And then I have stories about Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, Billy the Kid, Jesse James, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and the execution of his conspirators. And then other ones regarding some really interesting short stories about various crimes. And the two of them are really strange. One is they talk about the deadly blue gum Negro. And it was believed then that African Americans who had blue gums were as venomous as a rattlesnake.
Oh, geez.
And there are a lot of stories in this how people got in fights. They were bitten by somebody with blue gums, and they died a short time afterwards. And some of these people who bit other ones were executed. So it's a fascinating look at what people believed at the time, the craziness of it, and how people were treated. But I ended the book with something that is a story that is just as, well, as strong today as it was when it was written. And it was during the Civil War, and this woman, she was acting as a Civil War spy. She was in Washington, D.C. She'd dress up as a man, and she would take supplies to the Confederates. And she was caught several times by Union troops as she was trying to go across the Potomac, or she got across. And they knew she was a spy, and so they'd arrest her as a spy, and spies at that time were hung or they were shot. And every time she was caught, a letter would come down, a message from the Secretary of War, somebody else in Washington, D.C., to release her. And the general that had her in custody was always, what the hell's going on here? This is strange. She is a spy. They kept releasing her. Well, I did a lot of research on her and came up with the reason why, is that she was running a whorehouse in Washington, D.C., and an abortion clinic at the time, which was illegal. Jeez. And so her girls and she, they were servicing many of the politicians in Washington, D.C., and they were also providing abortion services when these senators and cabinet members, when their girlfriends, mistress, would get pregnant, they would perform the abortion. So this is why she was released all the time, because they were trying to keep this quiet, and it went on. But what was so bizarre about that is that in court, she was put on trial for murder, and she went after this guy that she was blackmailing, and he was sitting on, for better term, a little streetcar, and she walks up, and she shoots at him. She misses him, kills the guy next to him, had nothing to do with him, and she wounds this other guy. So she goes on trial for that, and the attorney brings up in court, and the judge talks about it, that, well, my client was basically mentally ill. And the judge says, well, how ill was she? And he says, ill enough to get off any criminal charges.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just told you. That's what happens today, you know, in the insanity pleas a lot of time. Because when I was a cop, I saw diminished capacity and all stuff in a lot of horrendous cases, you know, trying to get the person off. And that's how the game is played. It's theater in court in most cases. And so it was crazy. But the bottom line was, is that she was servicing probably a lot of cabinet members, maybe some senators herself, and not only her girls. And so that's why she was always released when she was actually a Confederate spy and she was caught. So it's a story that is as strong today as it was then, because as most people know, in Washington, D.C., if you can, it's good to have a politician in your pocket, but ultimately, it's better to have a politician in your bed, you know, for some woman like that to control them.
Absolutely. That's the way it's done. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, we'll look forward to having you back on and talking about True Crime Chronicles Volume 2, because it's been a fascinating interview with you today. Thank you so much for this interview, True Crime Chronicles Volume 1, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s. Thank you so much, Mike Rothmiller.
You're welcome.
You have a
You're welcome.
You have a great evening. Good night.
You too.